America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, as much of the world's attention is turned toward the struggle in Gaza, which Israel is very determined to win. The Biden administration apparently has other ideas. What are their ideas? And how would they like this war to work out, really, finally, definitively? We will talk about that and much more, including some dangers to the United States involving China directly and the Philippines, one of America's allies in East Asia. We'll be talking about that with somebody who knows the broad map of the world and where dangers lurk for the United States of America. He is our 27th Secretary of Defense, our 23rd Secretary of the Army. Dr. Mark T. Esper is also the author of the best-selling memoir, A Sacred Oath, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense During Extraordinary Times. Secretary Esper, thank you for joining us again. We always get a terrific response when you're on the show. Concerning what Lloyd Austin, your successor, tells the world, there is a pause now. They use the term pause in delivering the weapons that that Israel depends on and that the United States had committed. Is this a mistake?
Well, first of all, Michael, good to be back with you and your audience. I always enjoy being on the show. Look, with regard to the delivery of the arms, it's not something I would have done, or at least not done right now, because I think it sends the wrong messages, and not just to the Israelis, but maybe at this moment in time, Michael, more importantly, it sends a wrong message to Hamas. So when you think about Hamas as sitting down in Cairo or wherever, negotiating through intermediaries with Israel about the release of the hostages and about a temporary ceasefire and all the other things they want, each side is trying to gain leverage. And if you were kind of look back over the past 2 months or so, you would see that over time, Hamas continues to gain leverage and advantage because one thing after another is putting pressure on Israel to back down. I mean, you had the United States kind of weighing in, and then, of course, the student protests around the campuses kicked up, and they continue right now. And all this puts pressure on Israel and on Hamas. And here we are at a time when Hamas just rejected the latest ceasefire proposal, in which even the White House said was a good deal and Hamas should take it. Coming down on top of that, right in the wake of that rejection by Hamas, is word that the United States is going to cut off arms to Israel. So if you're Hamas sitting across the negotiation table, you should just continue to sit and wait and not do anything, because everybody else is going to continue to put pressure on Israel to change their position to end things. And so that's my bigger concern right now about the news on the arms delay.
Well, the one thing that Prime Minister Netanyahu has said is that the only way they are going to get Hamas to actually come forward to negotiations to releasing the approximately 130 surviving hostages, at least that we know about, including five Americans, the only way to get those people released is military pressure on those four remaining Hamas battalions. And that is what they are attempting to do with a very targeted mission so far in Rafah. Do you think that there is some hint of insight there in what the Prime Minister has to say?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of truth to that. This is a region of the world where power matters, where the will to fight and those things make a big difference. And that's why I say I think Hamas sees that with every passing day, at least week, they continue to gain or sustain their leverage. And this, the latest, is another example. Now, Bibi Netanyahu is trying to change the leverage by putting pressure, by moving forces down to the crossing in Rafah with the Egyptian border. You mentioned, Michael, the hostages. I got to be honest with you. I'm not sure that I believe what Hamas is saying. We know that there are about 132 a few months ago. We suspect 30 or so of those are now deceased. If I were negotiating, I'd want to see right now proof of life for the remaining 98 or so people, because for all we know, none of them are alive, I hate to say. And there may just be a negotiation going on where Hamas is playing bluff poker pretty well. And so I would be pressing for proof of life before, you know, we continue to negotiate with Hamas, because I'm not sure, unfortunately, it's tragically that all those hostages are there anymore.
Oh, this is a terrifying and sobering reality. Speaking of sobering realities, we were talking off the air for a moment, just before you came on, about very alarming developments involving China and one of our close allies in East Asia, the Philippines. What is the threat from the Chinese most recently toward our Filipino allies?
Well, you know, China for some time now, many, many years, has over-declared rights to large bodies of water to include the entire South China Sea, which captures the economic zones of many countries. In this case, it's the Philippines. And in one place called the Second Thomas Shoulders, a Philippine ship. It's actually an old American ship that we gave them. But there's a ship there with Filipino Marines who are trying to assert their sovereignty, Filipino sovereignty over this reef. And there's been a standoff going on for many, many months now between the Chinese Coast Guard and militia ships and the Philippine Coast Guard. And a week doesn't go by when there's not some type of confrontation. You've probably heard about it, the shooting of water cannons between the ships. The ships are bumping and so forth, and it continues to escalate. And my fear is that while we're all paying attention to Middle East and to Ukraine, we're going to see something flare up in the South China Sea between the Filipinos and the Chinese. And, of course, we're a treaty ally of the Philippines, and we'd be bound to support them. So we've also had Australia and Japan as well, with ships in the area also. So I think it's something for you know, you and your audience, all of us, to kind of pay attention to what's happening in the Indo-Pacific while we're all distracted elsewhere. The Chinese continue to kind of you know, bully other neighbors in the region.
Do the Filipinos have a substantial military?
No, they don't. Certainly not to take on the Chinese military. I mean, China has the largest navy in the world right now. And they have at least dozens of ships down there. So and nobody wants to kind of start a war. So they're doing this type of non-military bumping and, you know, using water cannons and shooting flares. And at one point used a commercial laser to blind a ship. And so it's one of those things that somebody makes a mistake or gets heated that you could have it open up into some type of kinetic conflict there pretty quickly. So again, it's something that we should be concerned about. I've always been concerned about the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. I think those are the two areas where you could see something flare up between United States, our allies, and the Chinese.
And you, Mark Esper, have always been an advocate of the rearmament of the United States and not allowing the Chinese to have the largest, if not the most formidable, navy in the world. His book, A Sacred Oath, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense During Extraordinary Times, that book is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com, together with some recent commentary by Dr. Mark Esper. And let us only hope that however this election turns out in the United States of America, that we have a new administration comes in committed to America's national security, peace through strength, as President Reagan maintained. We will be right back on The Michael Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show. All across America. This is The Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And And on the Michael Medved Show, Americans are longing. And it seems to me this is the overwhelming majority of Americans, liberal and conservative and in between, and people on left and right and center and above and below, and everybody wants to see the country come together a little bit on stuff that ought to be obvious, like dealing with some of the dangers in this world, the kind of military rearmament that we desperately need in our country, so that we aren't short of the weapons that were just voted to be authorized for Ukraine, let alone the weapons that are now on pause regarding Israel. But the one idea that seems to be able to unite pretty much everybody in the Congress of the United States is hatred and resentment toward Marjorie Taylor Greene. That was actually the reaction of the Congress when she spoke on the floor, calling to oust Mike Johnson as Speaker. And please understand, it's not so much that Republicans and Democrats united to support Mike Johnson, though he would deserve that. It's that they united to reject with great contempt Marjorie Taylor Greene. The Dateline from the Wall Street Journal, the House voted overwhelmingly yesterday to block a resolution by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to oust Speaker Mike Johnson, with Democrats stepping in to help save the Republican leader, closing for now another dramatic chapter in the GOP's intra-party squabbling. Greene, who had accused Johnson of, quote, betraying conservative principles on spending and foreign aid, forced to vote on removing the speaker despite the opposition of most other congressional Republicans and the opposition of former President Donald Trump. Her decision to trigger the motion to vacate the chair after more than a month of threats gave leaders two legislative days to bring it up. But Majority Leader Steve Scalise, the Republican from Louisiana, moved to immediately block the effort. There was a motion to table the effort, in other words, to put it aside and not consider it. That was voted in favor of tabling the measure, blocking Marjorie Taylor Greene. The vote was 349-43. Greene's motion occurred that way with seven members voting present, unable to decide. This is how she sounded on her failed and frankly pathetic and shameful effort to undermine the Speaker of the House. This is clip 18.
Now, I think it was a great victory yesterday. It was a great victory for the American people the truth, for the curtain to be drawn back and them to see the ugly truth.
Okay, well, the ugly truth, I'm afraid, is that Marjorie Taylor Greene is rejected by both parties. It is extraordinary, frankly, for the Democrats to come so overwhelmingly to Mike Johnson's support. And the only reason that Speaker McCarthy was actually voted out of power was because the Democrats behaved as the opposition party usually does. They didn't vote to return him as Speaker. They kept voting time after time after time for Hakeem Jeffries. But this time, the dread of going through that kind of chaos again that they went through with throwing out Kevin McCarthy, that was just too much for most Republican members. For instance, Representative Stephanie Bice of Oklahoma, she talked to reporters on the steps of the Capitol, clip 16.
We've been down this road. There is no plan. Marjorie wants to, you know, sow chaos and division within the Republican Party. Someone has to govern. We have the smallest majority in history currently, and this speaker has been put in an untenable situation to try to govern. With a one-seat majority in the House, Democrat-controlled Senate, and a Democratic White House, we are up against a wall here, and the American people are frustrated. They are angry. They have had enough. They want Republicans to govern. This does not help. It's not effective. It's actually sowing, I think, division within the conference. We've got to get back on track. We understand the frustration with the border. All of us standing here before you realize the border is an issue. We want to solve it too, but holding government hostage is not the way to do that.
Okay, very well said. Somebody who does not speak as as effectively or as substantively is Rashida Tlaib on the other side. She's a Democrat. The congresswoman from Michigan also spoke outside the Capitol and spoke about her favorite subject, Gaza. This is clip 15.
There are no universities left in Gaza.
Shame.
Israeli forces have killed over 35,000 Palestinians.
Shame.
They have slaughtered over 14,000 children. The entire population of Gaza is on the brink of starvation. Israeli forces are currently invading Rafah, where 1.5 Palestinians, including over 600 children, are trapped, living in makeshift tents without food, clean water, sanitation, medicine, or any form of shelter. To hear that a mother has to choose which child she's going to feed in Gaza, shameful. There is nowhere safe in Gaza, as the students have been trying to tell us over and over again.
Okay, the end to that situation would be easy if Hamas was willing to clear out its military forces and to release the hostages and to try to get an extended or even permanent ceasefire. She continued speaking about why she supports the demonstrators who are trying to shut down American universities. Clip 14.
Last night, under the cover of darkness, when Mayor Bowser was set to testify before Congress, before our committee, police pepper sprayed, brutalized, and arrested nonviolent student protesters at George Washington University at 3 a.m.
Shame.
Shame. This is an explicit attempt to repress students exercising their First Amendment rights to protest their university's complicit actions in the on behalf of Israeli's government's genocide of Palestinians. I want it to be clear. These students' First Amendment right does not end when they enter this campus of grounds. It always stays on them as Americans, as people, as human beings here in this country. It is outrageous that police are now entering college campuses across our nation.
It's outrageous that police are entering college campuses to prevent student activists from occupying buildings and shutting down university operations and threatening non-radical students. More about the perspective and the latest on the vice presidential hunt, all coming up on The Medved Show.
Michael Medved.
And on the Michael Medved Show, on the political front, we have been talking about the hunt for a vice president. It's extraordinarily consequential because Karl Rove wrote about this today. It's not just that there are occasions where a vice presidential selection makes a real difference, either positive or negative for a candidate. And you need only think of that, how much Ronald Reagan, for instance, was helped by selecting George Herbert Walker Bush, who had been his opponent in the primaries. And what his selection of Bush as his running mate showed was that Reagan was not some extremist from California, that he was willing to be a unifying leader for the entire party, which indeed he was. And if you compare that, as Karl Rove did in his column in the Wall Street Journal, if you compare that to what happened with John McCain selecting Sarah Palin. Now, I'm not saying John McCain would have won otherwise, but Sarah Palin didn't help because she took up so much of the attention with various gaffes. And the worst gaffe of all was where she was asked what she read every day, whether she read newspapers. And by the way, today newspapers have fallen so greatly, and so many people get their information from social media or from the internet generally, that it wouldn't have had the same impact. But back in 2008, which you can do the math, it's a while ago, it's four elections ago, that in 2008, when she was asked, what newspapers do you read every day, she said, oh, all of them. And she was asked, can you name one? And she couldn't. And if you read newspapers every day, you kind of know what they are. In any event, just as Sarah Palin had her gaffes, but she had her gaffes after her selection as vice president, which had come as a huge surprise. She had only just been elected governor of Alaska. And Alaska was not and is not a swing state. It is solidly Republican. So is South Dakota. And Mediaite is reporting that Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota appears to have ended her media tour to promote her new book. Her new book is called No Going Back. And this is Greg Gutfeld and Dana Bash both announced last-minute cancellations from the governor. Noem, once considered to be a front-runner for Donald Trump's VP spot, has gone through multiple tense and fiery interviews in recent days as she's attempted to promote her memoir, No Going Back, answering for several controversies from the book, including the admission she killed a puppy she deemed untrainable. As she killed him by shooting him in a gravel pit. And then she also, by the way, and she described it. So that was 20 years ago, right? But why describe it? This is not, I mean, if you're doing a memoir, every negative thing that's ever happened to you is not supposed to be in there. And certainly not shooting a dog, shooting your dog that you couldn't train and in a gravel pit. She also came back to the same gravel pit, and this is shortly thereafter, and killed one of the family's pet goats because it smelled bad. And that's also not one of the finest moments. You know, you always think of the Disney World exhibition. They have the Hall of the Presidents, and they had an attraction years ago in Disneyland called Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. It was originally displayed in the 1964 World's Fair, and it used excerpts from Lincoln's memorable speeches, and it was wonderful and inspiring. Great moments with Governor Noem, killing your puppy and then killing your goat. She also retracted her claim that she had met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un and that she claimed that he underestimated her. Well, how can he underestimate her? He never met her. He never had any contact with her. The governor of South Dakota isn't one of those world leaders that every head of state has to reckon with. CNN's Dina Bash announced yesterday during Inside Politics that she had planned on having Governor Noem on, but Noem's team canceled at the last minute. I don't think this campaign is headed toward victory. What Karl Rove writes is he says a lengthy process can expose weaknesses. Witness Governor Kristi Noem's stunning self-destruction, bragging about shooting her puppy in a gravel pit, ended her hopes of being selected. He also said that some of Trump's advisors want a running mate to win over targeted groups such as Black and Hispanic voters. These strategists are pushing former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, a Florida Representative Byron Donalds, a Florida Senator Marco Rubio, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, or Texas Representative Wesley Hunt. Wesley Hunt's got to be a long shot. He just only recently entered Congress. Others are hoping the right vice presidential candidate improves Mr. Trump's appeal among swing voters. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum and House GOP Conference Chair Elise Stefanik might fit that bill. Some running mates have been the ticket's attack dog. Donald Trump Jr. apparently likes Ohio Senator J.D. Vance for his ability to own the libs. Some want to strengthen Mr. Trump's outsider image. They argue for someone like Tucker Carlson, a former Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, until recently a Democrat, or a biotech mogul Vivek Ramaswamy. Really? Really? Bring back Vivek? And then he writes, vice presidential running mates seldom directly convert voters, according to studies. They rarely help carry a state that the ticket would otherwise lose. They have, at best, a minor and temporary influence on key voter groups. Whatever direct effect they have on the ballot is limited and generally lasts for a few days in a campaign. The power of a vice presidential pick is what it says about the presidential candidate. That's exactly right. Messrs. Devine and Kopko, who wrote a book on this, argue there's strong and consistent evidence that running mates shape voters' perceptions of the presidential candidate across a wide range of attributes relating to leadership skills, trustworthiness, and competence. And yes, Mike Pence was a very effective running mate for Donald Trump. And Tim Kaine, who nobody even remembers. You say, Tim Kaine? Who's Tim Kaine? Who's Tim Kaine? Tim Kaine is the stiff who was picked by Hillary Clinton to be his running mate, did not do well in the debate with Mike Pence, and basically contributed nothing to win an election. An election, by the way, that Hillary Clinton and her aides were convinced would be a landslide, that it wouldn't be close. And it's interesting to think about some of the other names that were kicked around as potential Hillary Clinton running mates who could have changed history. But now it's up to President Trump to make that decision. And some of the names on this list, kind of scary, aren't they? At least in terms of any Republican prospects. We will be right back on the Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show. All across America.
It's open, it's expansive, it's welcoming, it's filled with light.
This is the Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, the hush money trial proceeds. Stormy Daniels has concluded her 7 hours in as a witness. And has concluded, most people say, with at least some dignity and earning some sympathy from people who are paying attention. And the ones who are paying close attention are the jury, of course. Meanwhile, her testimony wasn't popular with everyone. Ted Cruz got on Fox News And remember, Ted Cruz had been subject, he was attacked in the National Enquirer and attacked for being a serial adulterer. And really, when you look at those charges from the National Enquirer, which like the charges that were filed against his father, Ted Cruz's father, claiming that his father had been involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. Really, yes, they did that. And then President Trump mentioned it. And it's one of the reasons that there was such bad blood between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. In any event, Ted Cruz, forgetting all of that, went on Fox News and, of course, supported President Trump and slammed Stormy Daniels. Here is what the senator from Texas had to say.
This is a political persecution, and it's not about crimes. If his name were Donald Smith, this case would have never been brought. The reason this is brought is they're trying to bootstrap a non-federal violation into a non-state violation, and they're trying to do to get this attenuated. And by the way, the testimony of Stormy Daniels that was salacious, that was the point of it. Listen, there is no person on planet Earth that believes Donald Trump has been celibate all his life. That is not news. But they want to drag him through the gutter because this is a political smear job. It's not about the rule of law. And it's frankly, it's tragic what is happening because the rule of law is important. It protects all of us. This is what banana republics do.
Okay, again, what I find interesting there, he's right that I think given the fact that President Trump has five children from three different wives, would understand that he has not been celibate all his life. Otherwise, were they all IVF or immaculate conceptions? I don't think so. Meanwhile, there is a great deal of information about the brain worm and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. A headline in the New York Times, supposed to be America's Journal of Record, it shows a very sour photograph of Robert Kennedy. And says, Kennedy says doctors found a dead worm in his brain. And in 2010, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was experiencing memory loss and mental fogginess so severe that a friend grew concerned he might have a brain tumor. Several doctors actually noticed a darkness or on the younger Mr. Kennedy and his brain scans, and they concluded that he had a tumor. That's what he said in a 2012 deposition reviewed by the New York Times. Mr. Kennedy was immediately scheduled for a procedure at Duke University Medical Center by the same surgeon who had operated on his uncle, he said. That was Senator Ted Kennedy. While packing for the trip, he said he received a call from a doctor at New York Presbyterian Hospital who had a different opinion. Mr. Kennedy, he believed, had a dead parasite in his head. Can you imagine the campaign posters with the caption, a dead parasite in his head? The doctor believed that the abnormality seen on the scan was caused by a worm that got into my brain and ate a portion of it and then died.
His brain is gone.
Well, not gone, but just chopped up, some of it eaten up by this worm. This was all said by Mr. Kennedy in his own deposition. It was a deposition in his divorce from his second of his three wives. He has gone to great lengths to appear hale and hearty, skiing with a professional snowboarder and with an Olympic gold medalist who called him a ripper as they raced down the mountain. A camera crew was at his side while he lifted weights shirtless at an outdoor gym in Venice Beach, California. He's 70 years old. Still, over the years, he has faced serious health issues, some previously undisclosed, including the apparent parasite. For decades, Mr. Kennedy suffered from atrial fibrillation, a common heartbeat abnormality that increases the risk of stroke or heart failure. He has been hospitalized at least four times for episodes, although in an interview with the Times last winter, he said that he was feeling much better and none of the symptoms were recurring, and that he had been a decade and believed the condition had disappeared. About the same time he learned of the parasite, he said, he was also diagnosed with mercury poisoning, most likely from ingesting fish containing the heavy metal. "I have cognitive problems, clearly," he said in the 2012 deposition. "I have short-term memory loss, and I have longer-term memory loss that affects me." And then there's information that when it comes to these parasites, the worms attacking your brain, there are 2,000 people every year in America who are hospitalized for that. Yesterday afternoon, hours after this article was published online, Mr. Kennedy posted a comment on his X profile. "I offer to eat 5 more brain worms," he said, "and still beat President Trump and President Biden in a debate. I feel confident in the result, even with a 6-worm handicap." Okay, he's joking about this, but is this going to have an impact on his campaign? And is his campaign going to have an impact on the rest of the election? There's actually a fascinating piece on the same page of the paper, and it says Kennedy presence on Texas ballot could help Democrat against Cruz. Now, he hasn't qualified for the Texas ballot yet, but if he gets on, the idea is that there are a lot of people, many of them Latino, who have a almost magical, mystical response to the Kennedy name, where Robert Kennedy's father, Robert Kennedy Sr., was particularly popular among the Latino community. And there are a lot of people who would otherwise stay home because they don't care about Biden or Trump, but who would come out to vote for Kennedy. And most of those people, the theory goes, would also vote overwhelmingly for Ted Cruz's opponent, Colin Allred, who was actually running close to Ted Cruz anyway. So they say Robert Kennedy Jr., the independent presidential candidate, is on track to submit enough signatures to get on the ballot in Texas, potentially setting the stage for a 3-way contest in the nation's second most populous state. While Mr. Kennedy is unlikely to win the Republican-dominated state, his addition to the presidential race in Texas could have an unintended consequence, lending a hand to the Democratic challenger seeking to upset Senator Ted Cruz. For weeks, the Cruz campaign has been privately expressing concern, seeing Mr. Kennedy as perhaps the biggest wild card in a race that Mr. Cruz had hoped to comfortably win. Texas has favored Mr. Trump in the last 2 elections, winning about 52% of the state's total in 2020. That's not a landslide. And if Kennedy ends up taking votes from Cruz, not just taking votes away from Cruz, but taking votes away from Trump, could Texas be in the running? All to be considered in this greatest nation on God's green earth.